Hello, welcome to Converging Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. On this episode, I am very happy to bring my conversation with Michelle Lamont. Michelle is a professor of sociology and of African and African American studies and the Robert I. Goldman Professor of European Studies at Harvard University. She is an influential cultural sociologist who mostly looks at issues of inequality, race, class, social worth across societies. She has received many awards, including honorary doctorates from 6 countries. She was the president of the American Sociological Association in 2016, Carnegie Fellow from 2021 to 2022. She's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the Royal Society of Canada, and the British Academy. She co-chaired the advisory board to the 2022 United Nations Human Development Report. And she is the author of many books, including the most recent one, Seeing Others, How Recognition Works and How It Can Heal a Divided World. And that's what we talk about in this conversation. We start by talking about definitions of recognition and worth and how we define them, what they are, what they aren't. The 3 avenues of building recognition in ordinary universalism. We talk about what blocks change, why we can't. We make some progress, why we can't make progress in other areas, at least seemingly. We talk about inequality, individualism versus collectivism, challenges of the American dream. We talk about media and how we can use media, the role of institutions, how we can recognize others, you know, practically and conceptually as a society, and many other topics. I was very, very happy to have this conversation with her. She is such a large figure within the sociological world, but also more generally. And she's really, really doing great work and trying to understand recognition, but also trying to understand inequality, issues of class, race, and really looking at how we're trying to evaluate our social worth within societies and between societies. Just really outstanding work that she's doing. So it was a big honor to talk with her. As always, you can find this conversation and all the conversations at convergingdialogues.substack.com. I'm also on YouTube. So get over there, like, subscribe, follow, share with your friends, listen to previous conversations. There's plenty of stuff there. And feel free to reach out and give any feedback if you like. Always love that. And now I bring you Michelle Lamont. I am here with Michelle Lamont. Michelle, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I'm greatly looking forward to speaking with you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. You have a very wonderful book out. It's called Seeing Others, How Recognition Works and How It Can Heal a Divided World. It's wonderful. This isn't your first book, is it? Or is it your first popular audience?
Several books. This is my fifth book, yeah. But yeah. I've done a lot of other edited volumes and stuff.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. So before we get into the book and all the things that you talk about in there, why don't you just briefly just tell us, listeners, who you are professionally, academically, and what you're currently up to?
Sure. So I'm a professor of sociology and African and African American studies at Harvard. I've been here for 20 years. I've written books on racial and class boundaries in France and the US. I have a book on racism in the US, Brazil, and Israel. I've studied peer review. So in general, my research is on definitions of worth and how they become shared and institutionalized, that is consolidated so that everyone shares them.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful. And I guess for this book, you are talking about recognition, which was really interesting. I like the concept. So maybe tell us just, I guess, kind of the main thrust or thesis of this book about recognition, seeing others, and why that's so essential for building a healthy culture.
Sure. So I started thinking about writing the book during the Trump presidency. I have friends here at Harvard who wrote an important book on the destruction of democracy titled How Democracies Fail by Levitsky and Ziblatt, and they're political scientists. And as during the Trump presidency, their book played an important role to give the general public the tools they needed to understand what was happening with democracy. They really were using their expertise as political scientists to make sense of that. Mm-hmm. And I became president of the American Sociological Association shortly after Trump became president. And immediately he did an executive order to ban travel to seven Muslim countries, and he started attacking trans rights. So I felt like, okay, it would be useful for the general public to have the tools they need to make sense of what's happening, you know, that it's several different groups that are being, you know, stigmatized and victimized like this. So that's why I decided to write this book on recognition. Mm. And it was also a way for me to cope with the fact that I was frankly depressed because, you know, we had thought that there was this arc of moral progress. And it seemed to me at the time that we're really going backward. So I read the literature on hope. Where do people find hope? How do people cultivate hope? And it all has to do with narratives, that is to being exposed to alternative stories that allow you to imagine an alternative future. Mm. So that's why I decided to do interviews with people whose professional life involves creating narratives. Mm. And the book includes interviews with 75 stand-up comics and Hollywood producers, people like, you know, the guys who created Queer Eye or Handmaid's Tale or, you know, The Good Place, Mike Schur, number of really important creators, and the stand-up comics also play, you know. So in general, I also did 185 interviews with people who work in narrative change across a large number of industries that involves policymaking, people who deal with, you know, racial inequality, all kinds of topics that help us understand that phenomenon.
Yeah, that sounds like such an experience that you had to being able to talk to all these different people.
Yeah, and also it was during the pandemic. So it was the beginning of the pandemic. So everyone had a lot of time on their hands. So I got to talk with a lot of people who would never have been available under other circumstances. So that was cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. So in recognizing people, and we'll talk about narrative a bit, but I guess when I was reading it, I was like, is it possible to recognize everybody? How could we do that? Or should we do that? Or, you know, how does that work?
Frankly, if you, if you think about resources, it's clear that if I have a cake and I take five pieces, there won't be as many pieces left for everyone, right? It's zero sum. When it comes to dignity, everyone can get dignity at the same time. So the idea that we're all the children of God, for instance, you know, it's not zero sum. Being recognized is about being viewed as valuable in the eyes of others. And this is something that we can all have at once. Now, where the difficulty is when we correlate like having dignity and respect with having or not access to resources. So some groups will claim monopoly on resources and will claim that they deserve more of them because of their greater dignity. So there we're not talking about worth. We're talking about social status generally, which may be correlated with, level of education or conceptions of merit that are zero sum at the end of the day. And often these things that are moral, like the question of what you merit, is often viewed as correlated with, you know, how hardworking you are. But in fact, meritocracy in general, like the children of the middle class, have a lot of advantages when it comes to success in life. You know, my kids have two parents who have PhDs, so they are usually advantaged, you know, and they live in a neighborhood where there are good schools. So if we live with the illusion that there is this, you know, even playing ground, it's a cultivated illusion because it's not true, you know. Mm. But on the other hand, some people succeed better than others also because they are hardworking. So
Where does this idea of worth, you say you've done a lot of research on this, what do we mean when we say worth, and what do we not mean when we say worth?
Yeah, well, it's very much about defining others as having a positive value. The counterpart is stigma. People who are defined negatively. And these two concepts, if you want, are the mirror effect at each other. What we don't mean is, oh, I recognize that this is an apple, or I recognize that this is Joe on the street. You know, it's not just a fact of simply recognizing something. It's really about evaluation and about you know, also often having a feeling of obligation toward others, because those we feel are worthy are often people toward whom we want to make contributions. So, for instance, those who study deservingness and support for the welfare state, it's often tied to whether or not people think that those who are claiming access to welfare, for instance, are deserving. And those are moral issues, so they're interconnected.
It's very interesting, because I think that, you know, I wonder, many of these things I agree with. I wonder how much of this, though, is where people will have a different value system or a different set of morals, where it will become kind of, you know, in the abstract, it will be, yeah, of course, you know, I want to value you and show you dignity. But if there are different sets of values and morals, that might be challenging to do, no?
That's true. But at the same time, like, let's say we live in American society. Everyone is exposed to the American dream. We all exposed to the notion that individualism is a good thing. So we have our own values, but we also share, you know, basically dominant narratives about what we're supposed to do with our lives, you know? So it's not entirely a question of individual choices. And one of the things that the book does is criticize the American dream for basically putting much more weight on those who have a college degree, who are professionals and managers, which has as a counterpoint the fact that all these people, the vast majority of the population that don't have a college degree, are often perceived as losers and as less morally worthy. So if we end up with things like the opioid epidemic and or, you know, the number of, you know, there's this important book by two economists titled Death by Despair, which is very much about how the working class has really lost its sense of being valuable. Well, that's the counterpart of us putting so much weight on those degrees and the capacity to consume as a basis for worth. So the book argues in favor of trying to foster in our society a more pluralistic understanding of who's worthy, that it's, you know, really important to say, well, you know, the people who are caregivers are worthy too, you know, and people who are spiritual leaders. So a pluralistic approach to worth is, I think, crucial, very crucial to a more healthy society, what we have now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I fully agree with you on that. I mean, I think that, you know, for a long time, the American dream really was for, you know, one particular group, and really left out other groups of people, intentionally or unintentionally, but it was, they were being left out. And so, yeah, I think, as you mentioned in the book, this way of expanding the American dream, where we can see that, and really having a true kind of liberal pluralism, right? Of how, how are we able to really to reach other folks, which I think is super important. You talk about these three avenues for building recognition. You talk about political activism and law, culture and media, and interpersonal networks. I'm assuming this is derived from all of the series of interviews you had with different folks in the book. Why these three avenues? Why are there other ways as well, or why these three specifically?
You know, there's different things that I say at different points in the book. So the section you're referring to here, I talk about, for instance, the law. Think about, you know, same-sex marriage. We know that when, after 32 states had passed same-sex marriage, the number of LGBTQ youth in high school attempted suicide declined drastically. So that's an example of how the implicit message contained in a law had a direct effect on how legitimate or worthy those young people felt. And once they have access to marriage, one of the most sacred institutions of our society, they felt much better about them themselves. So that's an example. I talk about networks because we really, you know, by talking to our friends and our family members, those who are close to us, we really gain messages and we reach understanding about who's worth our time and who's worthy. There's another part of the book, actually, that approach provides another understanding that is, you know, not about interpersonal network or the law or culture and media. The culture and media, I should say, before I go on, are crucial because if you think of all the shows that we watch on Netflix, they all have stories. There's a story, for instance, a study that showed that the vast majority of people in all those entertainment shows are upper middle class professionals and managers. It's very rare that you have a portrayal of working class people that are not buffoons or clowns or, you know, stupid people. Think about Bart Simpson, you know, as an example. So these messaging really can affect how we perceive who's worthy. But the book, actually, the three elements that are for me crucial for building recognition are a little bit different from what you mentioned. They are this focus on the pluralistic understanding of worth that I mentioned earlier. A lot of the interviews I did with workers before this book, they emphasize, you know, treat people as people. So this notion of ordinary universalism, which is really emphasizing what we all share as human beings. So a previous book titled The Dignity of Working Man, I did a lot of interviews with workers and they keep repeating, you have to treat people like people. And, you know, this idea of egalitarianism is crucial to their worldview. And for another, this book also, I interviewed a lot of North African immigrants who are basically analphabet, who lived in France at the time. And I asked them, what do you share? What do you have in common with French people? And they were victim of much racism at the time. You know, they still are. But these interviews I conducted in the early 90s, and they keep saying, well, we're all children of God. We all spend 9 months in our mother's womb. We all have 10 fingers. We're all insignificant, you know, in the cosmos, basically, or we all have to get up in the morning to buy our bread. So they put a lot of emphasis on what we all have in common as human beings. And the book also includes 80 interviews with Gen Zs, and the Gen Zs are really concerned with what I call ordinary universalism, which is really like, we're not going to put up with sexual harassment or with racism or with older men going out with young women. You know, there are lots of things that they have zero tolerance for because they think it's simply unfair and despicable. So that's, and then the third aspect that the book discusses is what I call reducing stigma. So I give the example, which I just mentioned, same-sex marriage, but there's also the example of people with HIV/AIDS. When the AIDS crisis started in the 1980s, they were extremely stigmatized. Everyone thought people who had AIDS were really like, basically it was the disease of gay men who were spending too much time in public bathrooms. But now this is a group that's not at all stigmatized. The moral stigma has been removed, whereas obesity remains really stigmatized. And I asked, how do you reduce stigma by comparing these two groups and showing how one group was destigmatized, whereas the other one stayed deeply stigmatized? And I showed that crucial in this are the mobilization of social movements, but also a lot of knowledge experts like legal and medical experts and social scientists and journalists who, through their work, explain to the public whether or not people are guilty or morally bankrupt. And that's why they get one disease or the other. So obesity has stayed very stigmatized because people who are obese are viewed as lazy or don't care enough about themselves to take care of themselves. You know, there's a whole range of argument about this. And the medical profession was not in agreement with the idea of destigmatizing obesity. They still, you know, basically there's a lot of blaming the people who are obese for their situation, which stopped happening with people with HIV/AIDS. So the point here is to say, you know, discrimination against the obese, it's not only something that's in people's head. It's also about the stories that societies tell about these groups and why they have these problems and whose fault it is. And the more we people our environment with narratives that are not about moral blaming, the more we allow more people to feel worthy, you know. So it's about the transformation of the narrative and that, in fact, this is something that's happening all the time and that we can all contribute to. So that's basically the key contribution of the book.
Yeah, no, I think there's so much wisdom in a lot of what you said there, and I think that it's important to see, you know, kind of the impact. And I thought it's interesting, you know, talking about with you know the current generation or you know, one of the youngest generations, Gen Z, and finding what they value and what they place and what they're not okay with. I think it's really important to have a good pulse on you know where the current generation is, which I think is you know really obviously invaluable. You kind of mentioned this here. So we have these various narratives, we have stigmas, we have stereotypes, social hierarchies. These are all these things that still reside with us as a society and as a culture. And, you know, these are human made, right? As you say, mm-hmm. why is it so hard to change or move past them or really have, you know, we can look towards many achievements and we can look towards progress for sure from 1980 to currently or 1990 to currently, but there's still a lot of major challenges in these areas. What's getting in the way of our ability to change these negative components of our society, do you think?
Well, social scientists point a lot to competition for resources. So when there's scarcity, mm-hmm. groups are really looking at their differences in status and they point to who has what and how do I rank in contrast to others. So that, of course, it gets in the way. And that's hard. You know, scarcity is part of the human, you know, tragedy. It will never go away. But on the other hand, social scientists also find that more contact help. So if you have never any contact with any other group, it's easy to really feed stereotypes and to dehumanize the other groups. So one thing we know is over the last decades, the frequency at which people with college degree interact with people who don't have college degree has enormously decreased. So there's very little interaction between these groups now. And the neighborhoods are increasingly more separated. So it means that the college-educated professionals have no idea what the life of the working class is like. And that really feeds stereotypes. And it also feeds racism because class is correlated with race. You know, there's a greater mm-hmm. concentration of people of color in the lower classes. So that yeah. also gets in the way. So that's why the penultimate chapter of the book also encourages people to really think about how they make choices about where they're going to live and where they're going to send their kids to school and who their kids are going to interact with as a way to create a society that is more embracing of diversity. A lot of upper middle class people, especially after 2008, they became very obsessed with what we call opportunity hoarding, which is to give as many resources as possible for their children. And that can also be very negative for the kids' mental health because they think like all this is being done for them to become hyperachievers. And if they don't achieve, their kids perceive like they're not worthy. You know, they don't think they matter unless they are able to achieve. So there's a lot of problem with mental health that comes with this. And so, you know, I mean, it's really about getting people to reflect on the choices that they make in everyday life and what kind of society we create as we make those choices and how what kind of world we want to pass on to our children.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think that's, well, again, this is why I brought up the current generation previously. I think it's really important to really consider that. And, you know, of course, young people have so much, you know, rigor and passion and things like that and idealism. And some of that probably, you know, in some ways, you know, has to be, you know, tempered with, you know, some reality-based things. But I think we need that kind of spirit and that energy from young people. And, you know, I'm always greatly impressed with the current generation of how, you know, kind of locked in, clued in they are to really important issues. And they're trying to decide the world they want to live in. So, you know, exactly. A lot of the times I feel like us older folks are kind of just like, you know, the anchor here, just still keeping things stuck, you know, a little bit. So
absolutely.
And just real quick, before we go on to some of the back to recognition, I want to ask about this idea you've talked about in different places here now, but there's this idea of like, so obviously, there's all different types of inequality, wealth inequality, income inequality, racial inequality, et cetera, on and on, inequalities in throughout the United States and throughout the world, really. And you kind of beat up a little bit individualism, right? A little bit. Mm-hmm. So is it a false dichotomy though, right? Because like pure collectivism also has its cons as well. It's not that we should all just be big collectivists of sorts, you know, individualism has its obvious cons and some of its pros as well. Is that, you know, do we need kind of both, right? Some spirit of individualism to develop things, but then also not forsaking many, many people and how we live in a big society and we need to be considerate of other people in groups different than us or similar. How do we understand or square these things with individualism and collectivism with all the inequalities we're facing?
Well, the good thing about individualism is it encourages agentic behavior, that is like entrepreneurialism and the idea that you take your life in your hands. But that exists in a lot of societies that are not as individualistic as you, we are. You know, people can be agentic in favor of their community as well. So, you know, I'm French Canadian. I grew up in a society that is way more collectivist than American society. And, you know, in some ways, maybe I'm more attuned to what comes with the positive things that come with the more community oriented society. The mental health crisis in this country right now is no joke, you know, and it's by the feeling of competitiveness that people are constantly facing, you know, with individualism comes unrelenting competitiveness. And people, there's a survey done every year at UCLA with the freshmen, and it shows the number of freshmen or first year undergrads who feel overwhelmed and anxious has grown exponentially for several, you know, several decades. So the level of happiness that comes with this individualism is seems to be diminishing rapidly. I think it worked great after World War II when the economy was in expansion and you had a lot of immigrants coming here to live the American dream and to experience, you know, the capacity to consume and to be upwardly mobile when they came from societies where everyone was stuck. But there's been increasing inequality for since 1980, and many people are not experiencing this anymore. The American dream does not deliver the way it did 60, 70 years ago. So that's a reality. Therefore, the importance of inventing new collective myth that will keep us going. And the idea of inclusion, I argue in the book, is very much replacing this focus on the American dream, because that's exactly what the Gen Zs are embracing. They want a society that is more inclusive. And they also blame us, the boomers and the Gen X, for really screwing up with the environment, and they're right. So they look at the life chance choices that we made with our cars and our big lawns and, you know, in the many ways in which that has contributed to destroying the environment. And they want to make different choices. And they also want to live very authentically, and they want to bring their best self to their daily life, as opposed to thinking, okay, if I work hard in 40 years, I'll have paid my mortgage. You know, for them, this is not a life choice that is very inspiring. So,
yeah, it just reminds me that we kind of get stuck in one way, and one way can work for a while, can work for a generation or two, but it doesn't work forever. We have to update, we have to evolve, and we have to, you know, when we say, well, this works, or this is efficient, or, you know, it's like, yeah, but it's, things aren't static. And I do feel that. And I feel that, you know, sometimes that challenge for me too, because there's things for me that, you know, that are like, this is how we do it. And this kind of works. And it's like, yeah, some of that, but you know, we update. So I think they push us in good ways. So back to recognition, you talk about how it's kind of conferred in different ways. You talk about representation, the right to vote, access to public resources, et cetera. How do groups get this kind of cultural membership, right? How do we go about, you know, fostering that and kind of really spurring that on?
Well, groups that have been stigmatized historically, like you think of African Americans, you know, what is the story of the 60s with the civil rights movement and the Black and Beautiful movement? It's really about transforming the collective identity. You know, collective identity is made of what the group thinks of itself, which is like self-identification, and what outsiders think your group is, which is called, you know, group, categorization, you know, what the other people think you are. And when you experience racism or discrimination, you try to readjust those things so that they match. So a lot of what happened in the Black Power movement, or, you know, in the through the civil rights movement, was African Americans challenging racism to say, you think we're XYZ, but this is not who we are. Who we are is this, these brave people, you know, Black is beautiful, celebrating their culture. And this adjustment happens, you know, in all groups. Like when I was growing up, the same thing happened in Quebec with transforming the definition of who French Canadians were. So it's a collective process. And a lot of what you read today in research, for instance, in psychology, is about, you know, really what happens inside the brains, you know, like the implicit association test that many organizations are using to make their employees realize that they maybe are racist, and when they're hiring, they have stereotypes toward members of various groups. Well, that's more at the psychological level. Well, in fact, you know, a lot of the changes I'm talking about are really at the level of, you know, shared representation of what groups are about, which are transformed or transformable.
Yeah, well, I think that that's, you know, how to go about, you know, trying to make these kind of groups in this kind of transformative way is obviously the challenge, which is, you know, I think it's super interesting what you talk about in one of the chapters about, you know, how we need certain change agents and organizations. And this goes to kind of what you're saying in the beginning about why media is super important, why we have to have healthy and accurate narratives that are telling all stories, right? All different stories. We have a lot of stories that are, you know, we've heard a bunch of times over and over and over, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that necessarily. But how are we telling more stories about more people in different ways? And this is, I think, really, really important. So yeah, could you talk about the role of healthy, accurate, updated narratives and the role of media?
Sure. So the 75 interviews we have with stand-up comics and Hollywood creatives, you know, we interviewed them about what drives them in their work. And many of them talked about their desire to challenge stereotypes. So they do it, for instance, through humor. Well, the comedians, their job is not to lecture the audience, right? It's to make them laugh. So they talk about various strategies that they develop to, in some ways, promote diversity at the same time as they do their job of making people laugh. So we come up with these various strategies that they describe. So one of them is what we call the Trojan horse, which is the idea that you tell your joke, but at the same time, implicit is, let's say, making fun of the racist or making fun of, you know, the wealthy who are selfish and don't take care of other people. So it's really, they're very reflexive about the various strategies. Or, you know, just make group visible. Like, you know, if you are trans and you live, let's say, in a red state where your reality is never acknowledged, it is extremely harmful, you know. Epidemiologists talk about what they call allostatic load, which is the impact of seeing negative depiction of who you are every day, which really, they say, you know, the wear and tear of everyday life that gets under the skin and really affects health outcomes, both mental health and physical health. So this needs to be challenged, you know, through the projection of alternative narratives about who you are. So all these people who were interviewed for the book are very much in the business of redefining reality so that the lenses through which we perceive people humanizes them and are less stereotypical and are more three-dimensional. So I'll give you a concrete example. Sure. The Ford Foundation, which is one of the largest foundation in the U.S., the president decided when he was appointed 10 years ago that he was really going to focus on fighting inequality. But instead of just fighting inequality by redistributing resources, he said, we're going to change narratives. So he calls it changing hearts and minds. So they put a lot of money in the creation of new narratives. So one of the organizations they support, well, actually, it's one of their internal thing or off agencies called Just Film. And Just Film created, contributed to the creation of the film Roma, which won an Oscar a few years ago. And it's the story of maids who work for a middle-class family in Mexico City. And those maids, you know, often maids are not the center of the story. They're just in the background. But these maids, they are indigenous women. You follow them as one of them needs to have an abortion. So it really, like, the story humanizes them and, you know, depicts them in a three-dimensional way. And it really allows the public to relate and to understand them as human beings. So, and then that film then was also supported by an organization, which is also supported by the Ford Foundation, called the National Alliance for Domestic Workers, which is basically the union for domestic workers who are typically underpaid and certainly not unionized. So, and that lived under terrible conditions because a lot of them are undocumented. And, you know, with a very explicit goal to transform our representation of what the life of maids are like. And then it was diffused on Netflix and it was really scaled up, you know. I mean, many people saw that film. So it's not only producing the narratives, it's also making sure that the narratives get to be extremely widely diffused. And that's done in part through collaborations with philanthropies such as the Ford Foundation, but also mediums such as Netflix. You know, I interviewed the global VP for Netflix, Channing Dunaway, who was, you know, in that position in 21. And she pushed for the creation of Black Panthers, you know, a lot of film that were really challenging the representations of Black people, you know. So there's an element of cultural engineering in the creation of those new narratives that plays an extremely important role in our society. And many people are not aware that this is happening and how important it is. Mm. Another example would be Nicole Hannah-Jones, who I interviewed, who's behind the 1619 project, which kind of redefined the history of America by centering on slavery to say, yes, it's a country that became extremely rich, but it became extremely rich in part by not paying our Black people who were slaves. And it's not just the history of the inherent genius of American society, you know. And that led to what we see today with DeSantis and the the cancellation of critical race theory in Florida. So it had a huge impact in redefining the debates that we have in American society on the history of our country and what we owe Black people, et cetera. So it's very significant, I think.
On the Roma piece is very interesting. It's a beautiful film. I absolutely loved it. And it reminds me also, I had on the podcast Blair Kelly. She wrote the book Black Folk, which is the roots of the Black working class. And mm-hmm. in her book and in the conversation I had with her, she talks about, Black maids, in the Jim Crow South and how they go unrecognized and what many of the things that had happened, and really just telling the historical narrative that is, super important, for a much larger audience and for the Black community as well. And it's important. I think it's important that we're able to tell accurately stories that we haven't heard, or we should know. And I think that, yeah, of course. I mean, I think there's a respectful way and an honest way to tell those stories, but we need to have people to know, if you have a big place, a big country, and it's very diverse, well, there's going to be a lot of different stories out there. And so giving space and time to hear all of them is absolutely important.
There's also some narratives that are plain wrong, that are forgetting mm-hmm. large parts of the story. So I think the case of 1619 was bringing a very essential corrective to the traditional story of American exceptionalism, which was totally ignoring the fact that a large proportion of the population was absolutely exploited, So. It's not only a question of pluralism, it's a question of correcting lies.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, I think that, like I said earlier, we get used to certain stories a certain way. And then when we have, kind of an updated or a correction, there is a lot of resistance. I had another historian on here, and she wrote this book called The Three-Cornered War. It talks basically about North and South, but it talks about in the West during the Civil War, the involvement of Native Americans. And we don't hear that story a lot. And it was quite wild how much pushback that book got. I mean, it was well revered in many circles. I think it was nominated for the Pulitzer, but it was also got a lot of backlash as well. And it's like, well, why are you telling this story? And it's like, well, it happened, or we should correct some of the stories that we've been told. So, it's interesting how these things, kind of push people in all these ways. But yeah. in terms of with groups, one of the things I guess that is interesting for me is how do we on all sides of it, how do we ward off against groupthink, right? How are we able to say we don't want to just kind of get siloed And we just kind of do a bunch of nodding and say, yes, you know, my group thinks this. So that's what I think. How do we not do that much, you know, where we're just kind of acquiescing to whatever the group says and that we're still able to have, you know, good discussions and things like that within groups, between groups. But how do we ward off against groupthink, I guess, in many ways?
Well, in the book, I talk a lot about fighting spatial segregation, you know, the question of who we are in touch with. On as we live our everyday life is absolutely crucial, which is why, you know, we have to give thought to what neighborhood we're going to live in and, you know, what club also we join. You know, are we going to be in all white churches or are we going to seek environments that are a little bit more diverse? And societies engineer their diversity very differently. In Canada, you know, when immigrants come, they get free language courses. And there's a lot that is put in place to help them integrate, with the result that many more of them run for office and are also voting. They're cognitively much more engaged in the society they live in. So putting in place these kinds of structures that facilitate communication and integration is absolutely crucial. Leaving it to market forces and often just lead people to isolate themselves within their own groups. And that is not very good for the creation of a society that has more coherence and cohesion.
Mm. So one of the last two questions I have here is, you know, we've talked a lot about different people and different groups and different communities, and all of that is tremendously important and necessary, right? These things aren't going to kind of just move on their own. But what is the role you feel of institutions, whether the ones we have now, or new ones we can create, but what is the role of institutions with groups and individuals in helping to kind of recognize and create important changes for our culture?
Mm-hmm. Well, one obvious change that we've seen over the last decade is, you know, how large corporations have put in place diversity inclusion programs, DEI programs. And these programs have often put a lot of emphasis on diversifying the workforce, you know, hiring more people of color, hiring more women. But these programs are often quite limited because a lot of the people who are in charge of them are people of color themselves. So it's a little bit like double burden. Not only do they experience microaggression all day, but on top of it, they have to teach their white coworkers about how to create diversity. So recent research shows that, in fact, it's much more promising to make everyone, all the middle managers in the corporation in charge of the promotion of diversity and to simply create a more inclusive culture for all. So that would be an example of institutional change that is much more likely to be productive than the way that diversity programs are institutionalized in most universities, in most large corporation or organization these days, including universities.
So I guess the last question here is, you know, how do we have recognition? How are we able to see other people? And you kind of end at the end of the book, you talk about, you know, ordinary universalism and why that's important for society. So could you just talk to us about that and how we can truly recognize other people around us?
I think that was very central to the interviews we conducted with the Gen Zs who were basically 80 young people who were studying during the pandemic in the Midwest and the East Coast. And they really want to celebrate this ordinary universalism and how they live their everyday life. And they want to really make abstraction of what, you know, your sexuality or your ethno-racial identity. They think of these things as kind of inherent to who the person wants to be, and they celebrate authenticity. So I don't know.
What are your kind of final thoughts on how we can see others and how we can really create change in society that we all want to have?
Yeah. Well, the book is really in some ways an opportunity to get people to think, but really to try to understand better where other people come from. You know, it's not about, you know, what are the five things that managers should do to create a better workplace. It's really a reflection about how to generate environments where people are much more thoughtful and willing to step in other people's shoes to understand their lived reality. And to really also be critical of, you know, those of us who have college degrees, you know, we maintain these really strong role boundaries that are for a large proportion of the population, and the need to reconsider how we do this, because I don't think it's sustainable. I have huge American cities like LA, Philadelphia, New York, with enormous population of homeless all over. So, you know, you have this world of hyperabundance, which lives just next to absolute, you know, human misery. So, you know, like really inviting people to think more about what kind of world do we want to give to our children. And that really requires away from this culture of, you know, accumulation of the individual versus, you know, trying to create a more embracing society that helps us develop in many more ways. So that's, yeah, that would be, I think, the ultimate goal of the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, to me, you absolutely you hit a home run with it in the book, and it's very concise and very much able to get to it, which is wonderful. The book is called Seeing Others: How Recognition Works and How It Can Heal a Divided World, and it's fabulous. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on and talking about your work and about your research, and we really need more folks like you. So it was absolute pleasure to have you on and talk with me about all these themes.
Thank you so much for your invitation. I really appreciate it.